I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. Professor Jeffrey Arnett is our guest this hour. You may have seen this article in the New York Times Magazine on June 20th. It's official, the Boomerang Kids won't leave. And it prompts our conversation this afternoon. It starts with the story of Annie, who graduated recently from Loyola University in Chicago. Well, not all that recently. She's living with her mom in Downers Grove, Illinois, and has been struggling to support herself in the midst of the recession. She's working a series of unsatisfying jobs, has been in her old bedroom for 4 years now. But maybe the story isn't entirely bleak. There are a lot of young people in their 20s and 30s who are living with their parents, and a huge number, well over half of all young adults, are receiving financial support from them. Many of these people are college graduates and they're having a hard time finding a job, or they're underemployed, making substandard wages. Is living with your parents a sign, as it once was, of failure? Or is it, as the article asks, a practical long-term financial move? And why is it happening? Why is it different for young people now? Jeffrey is our guest this hour. He's the originator of the theory of emerging adulthood, human development from ages 18 to 29. He's written extensively on this topic. Research professor in the Department of Psychology at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, and author of When Will My Grown-Up Kid Grow Up? Loving and Understanding Your Emerging Child. And we'll be welcoming phone calls if this is what's happening in your life, or if you have thoughts about why this is the case in our society, we would like to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Arnett, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Glad to be with you.
You know, it is amazing. I read those statistics and then I read them again and think, oh my goodness, these are a large number of people who are living with their parents, and a lot of them are college graduates and they're just not finding work. When you look at that as a broad thing, you think something's different here. Something may be off, maybe it's okay, but something has changed substantially.
Yeah, no doubt. But I think one thing that's important to bring in here, Kathleen, is that the ones who are not college graduates have an even tougher time. The New York Times article kind of glossed over that. But in my research and research by many other people, it's been clear that the college graduates have a bigger advantage than ever before over the non-graduates because of the way the economy has shifted so much from manufacturing to jobs that require information and technology skills. So I'm not unsympathetic to the college grads who can't find work, but their unemployment rate is less than half of the rate for people who have not attained a college degree.
Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that within a few years, they should be doing much better.
Yeah, over the course of a lifetime, according to various projections, they make about $1 million more than somebody who has high school or less. So, again, I'm not unsympathetic to their struggles, but I think too often we forget that the people who have less education are the ones that we really need to attend to more because they are not prepared for this information and technology economy, and they're likely to struggle lifelong.
In some ways, it makes perfect sense. As the mom of one of these emerging adults, I, of course, would love to have my son just stay home until he's 40 because I like having him home.
And and you're like a lot of other parents. It works out remarkably well.
Yeah, I know. And he's moving out, though, in a couple of weeks, so I have to deal, I have to deal with all of that. But there is something, and when you look at the history of all this, there is something about families staying together because they work together for a long period of time. There shouldn't be anything really shameful of having a place where you can go where people love you and will help you along if you're having a little bit of trouble negotiating the world financially or getting a job or whatever.
Well, even if you're not having trouble, I mean, why shouldn't you live at home if that's acceptable to everyone involved? Really, families have always been about mutual support.
Mm-hmm.
and this sort of generational mutual support arrangement where parents help their kids grow up, and then when the parents get old, their kids take care of them. And for some reason, we've tended to stigmatize that in recent generations and have this view that if kids are still home beyond the age of 20, there's something wrong with them, or their parents are too involved, or there is an economic tragedy or something, framing it in this negative way. But I don't see any reason for that. I mean, sometimes it is a sign of problems. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's always a good thing. But the idea that you should be suddenly prepared to go out and fend for yourself at the age of 19, 20, 21 years old, I don't see why that's the new ideal. That's not necessarily a good thing for people.
But didn't we used to be in the not too distant past, and doesn't it indicate that there's some broader force to, at work, because we used to be able to graduate from college. When I graduated, most of my friends were getting married at the age of 22. They were having children by the age of 23 or 24. That sure isn't happening right now.
No, it sure hasn't.
So what does it say about what's going on in the larger society?
It says a lot. And your experience, what you remember from when you were that age, is exactly what was happening to most people at the time. In 1970, the median marriage age for women was 21.
Oh, my gosh.
And
wow.
It was 23 for men. Well, now it's 29 for men.
Wow.
And it's about 26 for women, almost 27. So things have really changed in just a relatively short time. And there are a lot of reasons for that. I'm sure we could talk all day about it. But some of the main reasons are that, first of all, the economy has changed. And so it takes longer to prepare yourself for it. You really do need education beyond high school now, maybe not a four-year degree, but some kind of training or education after high school. And also the women's movement. I'm sure a lot of the women you knew when you were young, if you were coming of age and the 60s or 70s were planning on wife and motherhood,
right.
and a lot more people were in those days, and not really having much of a plan in the way of a career. Now almost all young women have career goals as well as family goals, and so that makes them less eager to jump right into motherhood at the age of 20, 21, 22. They want time to develop their careers. There's also the sexual revolution. The birth control pill in 1964 truly was revolutionary in terms of giving people control over their reproductive lives and their sex lives. And it meant that sex didn't need to be as closely linked to marriage as it had been in the past, because it's highly effective if people use it responsibly.
Mm-hmm.
So all those things have contributed to making adulthood come later than it did before. I mean, we say 30 is the new 20, right? That's the popular phrase. And there's a lot of truth to that, that the entry into a stable adult life now comes closer to 30 than to 20. And there's this new thing in between, this new life stage that I call the emerging adulthood. I think that's a useful way to think about it, is that really there's a new life stage now in between adolescence and a stable young adulthood.
And when you say, Jeffrey, that it could be problematic, not everything is real rosy in this area, what are the problem areas?
Well, a big problem is not being prepared for the labor market, not having the sort of training and skills for the jobs that are available. But there are a lot of other problems, too, that are actually more common during the 20-something years than either before or after. So things like anxiety disorders and depression, substance use and abuse is a big problem in the 20s, more than any decade afterward. Mental health disorders of a wide variety of types first have their onset in the 20s. So a lot of them are struggling not only with the economic challenges and the educational challenges, but with various kinds of mental health challenges as well. And that's often what brings them home. If they are suffering from these things, they find they can't fend for themselves in the world, and so they go home and try to get on their feet again.
Mm-hmm. And what about what we traditionally have thought of, at least in recent times, what happens to you when you're on your own. You're on your own in your 20s. You learn how to manage your own finances, meager as they may be. You're doing your own cooking. You're navigating the world. Aren't those skills that are valuable to acquire when you're in your 20s?
Yeah, they are. And most people acquire those things one way or another. I think another big part of it, though, Kathleen, is that they have very high expectations for work. And
right.
most of them don't want to just make a living. They want to find something that's more meaningful than that and more enjoyable than that. And so one thing that brings them home is that they're in a dreary job that they hate. And they think to themselves, my God, I don't want to do this for the next 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I need to do something else. I need to be able to focus on finding a different job. And that's hard to do when you have a full-time job that you're working at every day. Or they say, I need to get some other kind of education or training. This is not something that I enjoy, and I want to find something I do enjoy. And so I'll go home, and I'll go back to school, and then I'll prepare myself for some other occupation.
And would you say, though, that primarily the reason that all this is happening, as the New York Times article indicates, is because of all these financial changes that have taken place, the number of jobs that have gone overseas, the loss of certain kinds of employment that people 30 years ago would step into, this whole
right.
different financial world that may be problematic for people in this generation for some time to come?
Yeah, I would. I would say that's the biggest reason, but it's important to keep in mind these other things, the changes in women's roles,
right.
the sexual revolution, the higher expectations for work. Those are all involved as well.
We welcome phone calls. I have a feeling we're going to have quite a few on this topic because it's happening in large numbers. We're looking this hour at Boomerang Kids, the number, and a lot has been written about this, most prominently New York Times Magazine section, June 20th, and our guest this hour was prominently quoted in this article. Professor Jeffrey Arnett is the originator of the theory of emerging adulthood, human development from the ages of 18 to 29. He's a research professor in the Department of Psychology at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, author of When Will My Grown-Up Kid Grow Up? Loving and Understanding Your Emerging Child. The statistics you probably know, one in five people in their 20s and early 30s currently living with his or her parents, 60% of all young adults receiving financial support from them. So it's nothing to be ashamed of, right? It's pretty commonplace. Nearly 45% of 25-year-olds have outstanding loans with an average debt. It's significant, above $20,000. More than half of recent college graduates are unemployed or underemployed. And those who have not attended college, we'll talk with Jeffrey about that. I would imagine that their situations are not very happy. All right, to you momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now for Professor Jeffrey Arnett. 800-486-8655 is our number. And Liz in Sister Bay, our first caller.
Hi there.
Hi.
Well, I'm listening and I'm really agreeing with so much of what you're saying. And at the same time, I've got a little chip on my shoulder and I find myself rankling at kind of the sweeping nature of some of the conclusions because it sounds minimizing to me. I've got one adult daughter and her fiance live with me, and they're entrepreneurial. They're starting a business, and they had planned on getting their own place, which struck me as incredibly foolhardy because I have a big place, and it just seems foolish when they should not be spending unnecessarily. How
uh-huh.
silly to go and rent a place when there's a place to be. And I have a older son who I would love to move home because he has an idea about starting a business and he and I would like to do something together. But I know what's in the way is that idea that you can't move home. And there's a cultural negativity toward it. And it seems so ridiculous. And we've got all of these older folks living in this country who could be living with their families, or their families
right.
could live with them. And the multi-generational family seems like such a good thing. And I would love to be able to be a grandma in the house with my grandchildren. And I don't like the pathologizing of adult children living with their parents, and I don't like the emerging adult term. It sounds minimal.
Well, I actually devised that term to make it more positive. I mean, I don't think it's minimal. I think it normalizes it. It makes people realize that this is now what is typical, is people, or for people to have the experience in their 20s of doing exactly what your daughter's doing, taking different chances, trying different opportunities, trying to develop their lives in a way that will be more positive for them in the long run, instead of rushing into adult roles as people did 50 years ago at the age of 20, 21, 22. So I would disagree that it's minimizing. I think it's quite the contrary. And I've talked to innumerable emerging adults who, and their parents, who find it very refreshing to hear that this is normal. And I think that's the value of the emerging adulthood term, is that it does make people realize that this is the new normal. But I agree with you, absolutely, and I hope I've made that clear, that I think it is a positive thing, or at least a potentially positive thing. In a national survey that I directed of parents of 18 to 29-year-olds for my book with Elizabeth Fischel, I wanted to mention her. She's my co-author. And the book actually, the title is Getting to 30, A Parent's Guide to the 20-something Years. It's out in paperback now, so I want to mention that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the national survey of parents of 18 to 29-year-olds that I directed for the book, we asked parents who had a child living at home, that was about 40% of parents, if their experience with that situation was positive, negative, or a mix of positive and negative. And 61% of parents said it was mostly positive. Only 6% said it was mostly negative, and the rest were a mix of positive and negative. So a lot of parents are having an experience like yours, Liz, that it's a positive experience, and they're very favorable about it. And so am I.
Mm-hmm. There is still, I think Liz is right, that there's this cultural perception, and I hear it among people my son's age and friends of his, that there is this perception that you're a certain age and by golly, you should be out on your own, and they feel badly about living with their parents. And there's nothing wrong with living with your parents. I mean, so many of their friends are doing that, but still the stigma is strong, isn't it?
Yes, and as I said at the outset, throughout human history, this is the way families have been organized,
mm-hmm.
is that parents help their kids as their kids are growing up and moving toward adulthood, and then when the parents get older, the kids help them. So this is the way human societies have traditionally set up. And the idea that you should leave when you're 18, 19, 20 years old and somehow fend for yourself, that's what's new. And now I think we're moving back toward the tradition of parents helping out their kids as long as their kids need it. And parents, I should remember that, you know, they're likely going to need their kids' help someday. And if not financially, then helping them with other necessities of daily life. So it still does make sense for parents to be generous to their kids when the kids are making their way toward adulthood, because they are very likely to need their help eventually.
Absolutely. Nothing wrong with generosity. Can't be beat, if you ask me, right?
Yeah.
It's a good quality. Thanks,
practical
Liz.
Too.
Yeah, absolutely. All the best to everybody in Sister Bay. Ralph in Little Suamico, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Some of the things have been addressed already since I called, but you know, it varies a lot depending on the situation, because in some situations the college graduate or the adult child is going to have a job, and other ones times they're not. Are they going to contribute towards the household or are they not? You know, are they welcome or are they not? You mentioned the 6% not welcome or that are having difficulty. Probably it's higher than that, because parents aren't likely to answer a survey and say, I don't want my kid in the house with me. I think it's important to support while they're at school. You know, if you're supporting them because they just haven't looked for a job and they're just sitting around the house. It's so variable that I think it depends on the situation a lot.
Well, I think you make a good point. I mean, surveys do depend on people answering them honestly. But there was also the option of a mix in positive and negative. And I don't think there had been any stigma in admitting that there's some negative things about living with somebody. I mean, I think that'd be true of almost anybody you live with, things you like and things you don't like. So I still do think that's very striking that 61% would say it's mostly positive and only 6% mostly negative. And I think that really does reflect that it is usually a very positive experience. And I want to mention, too, that there are very few that are just lying around and taking advantage of their parents. That is a cultural stereotype right. That we have, that they exploit their parents' generosity and the parents can't wait to get them out of the house. But that's really rare that that's true. I don't doubt that it does happen. But it's extremely rare. They realize that they're at a time of life where they have to make strides toward building an adult life for themselves. Mm-hmm. And by and large, they're doing that. They're working very hard. It's absolutely not fair to stigmatize them or stereotype them as lazy, because just the opposite is true. They're mostly working hard at low-paying jobs, and they're more likely to be going to school and working simultaneously than people were a generation or two ago, because the cost of going to school has risen so much.
Yes. Thank you so much. Before we go back to phone calls, we should spend time, because we tend to focus on those who are college educated, young people who are in this age group who have not graduated from high school, who must be struggling.
Yeah, they are. And I really think we need to do more as a society to support them and to make it possible for people to get the education and training they need. I've been thinking about this a lot lately and writing about it some, how I really feel like we're at a point in the early 21st century that is comparable to where we were in the early 20th century for secondary education and the early 19th century for primary education. I mean, really having any education at all, even having literacy, is a relatively new thing historically. But at the beginning of the 19th century, we realized as a society, well, people need to be literate. It's not enough just to work on a farm anymore. There are more jobs now that require literacy. And so we established a system where everybody gets primary education. And then at the beginning of the 20th century, we realized, well, that's not really enough just to be literate. People need more education than that. So we made secondary education universal. And I think what we'll see in the 21st century and what we need to see is to make tertiary education universal so that everybody gets the opportunity to have some kind of education and training beyond high school. High school is not enough for the modern economy.
Let's go next to Mark, Richland Center. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to second the notion that the way that the social structure had been organized, that this phenomena of individualized lives and ownership of houses and such like that is a relatively new thing. And I'd just like to bring to the discussion two things. One, the rites of passage that we don't actually do so much in our rearing of children today. We don't actually bring them through these rites of passage that ask them, instead of what our present questioning of children and says, what are you going to do for yourself when you grow up? Those rites of passage used to require that they prove their abilities to be part of the community. So that's not something that's part of our social structure. And with regard to the individual ownership of housing, it's interesting that the American Real Estate Association came into being almost immediately after the Federal Reserve System of our monetary system. And if you're going to base money on debt, you have to have debtors. And what better way to do that than to separate people into individual houses? And grandma and grandpa don't live with mom and dad anymore because they've got their own mortgage. And I think there's something to that.
What an interesting call.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, mm-hmm. You know, that brings up that issue of housing. And it's interesting how, compared to 50 years ago, houses are twice as big as they were, and yet families are half the size. because the birth rate is only about half of what it was in 1960. And so there's certainly room, I mean, for parents who do want their kids at home. Not all parents do. I mean, we should think we should recognize that. Some parents really do sort of believe their kids move on. But it's not a space consideration. I mean, houses are bigger and families are smaller. So there is that option for most families in terms of making room for their grown kids to live at home.
Thank you, Mark, so much for your call. Zachary in Eau Claire. Hello, Zachary.
Hi. I was a really well-to-do undergraduate. I was totally subscribed to that theory of I'm going to be an independent person. I had gotten into NYU for grad school, and then I immediately developed bipolar disorder at 20. It was full-blown mania, absolutely not something you can manage on your own. And even with good friends, even with a college environment, even with professionals around you, it's not enough without your family. Mm-hmm. And I think we've forgotten that a lot in the modern age, how important the family unit is. Mm-hmm. And so I did make the decision to drop out of school and move home. And I moved in with my mother. And things were not great, but we definitely worked through it. I needed somebody there who was able to help me through my mania, help me through my psychosis, the voices, and someone who knew me well enough to know when I needed to go to the hospital. That night, that might not have happened with just friends in college, especially as the doctor mentioned, with the incidence of drug use in your 20s. You know, a lot of kids are doing drugs, and it increases their susceptibility to these mental health issues, and it also separates them and makes them think, oh, he's not really having a problem. He's just off on a drug or something. And they leave you alone, and that's not really what it is anymore. And with this incident of mental health being more and more diagnosed in our 20s, it was pointed out to me by a good doctor in New York, why are you here in New York? You need to be with family.
Oh.
You can't be out here on your own.
Right.
Well, I really appreciate your frankness, Zachary, in sharing that story, and it's a good example of what I was talking about earlier, how there are a lot of mental health disorders that have their onset in the 20s, and bipolar disorder is one of them. Schizophrenia is another. Major depression, anxiety disorders. There's a whole range of mental health problems that can have their onset, or most likely to have their onset during the 20s. Eating disorders is another one, as well as substance abuse disorders that you mentioned as well. So often, people who have these disorders really need the help of their parents and can't deal with these things on their own. And it's one time where it's especially crucial for parents to step in and be willing to provide help if it's needed.
Are you able to continue with school, Zachary?
I've been trying. It's been difficult here in the UW system. I went to a school in St. Louis, Webster University. So as a senior, I didn't have the ability to transfer well.
Mm-hmm.
So that has not been a good transition. And Webster doesn't offer scholarships to fifth years. So it's been an odd predicament. But since my main goal is to be an artist, and since NYU at least gave me the offer of, hey, come study with us, I at least know that I have an ability in music and theater and all that, and I'll hopefully pursue that on my own without a degree, as it is one of the fields that doesn't require education.
Yeah. You sound so optimistic, Zachary, don't you? You just sound good.
I am optimistic. You know, the universe has a way of telling you what needs to happen.
Mm.
You know, one of the psychiatrists in New York was very honest with me and said, this keeps happening to you, and especially every time you come to New York, this happens to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's the universe telling you you're not ready to do this just yet. Sort yourself out and come back when you're ready.
Mm. All right. Thank you so much, Zachary, for calling. Yeah.
Zachary's optimism is a good example of how emerging adults generally are optimistic and how it's a psychological resource. You know, they're sometimes ridiculed for expecting too much out of life, and sometimes they do. But I have learned to see their optimism as a psychological resource for them to draw upon when times are tough, as they often get to be at some time during their 20s. In the poll that I mentioned earlier, the Clark University poll of emerging adults, the national survey of 18 to 29-year-olds that I directed, 9 out of 10 of them agreed with the statement, I am confident that eventually I will get what I want out of life.
Oh, goodness.
And so that means almost everybody, even people like Zachary who have struggled and are dealing with a very serious problem of one kind or another, almost all of them believe that eventually life will smile on them. And that's what gives them the energy to get up in the morning and try to make their way out of the problems they have towards something better.
Mm. And is that new? I was thinking about being 21 when you just said that. I guess I would have said that I was, if you had asked me at 35 or so, it would have been a different response. But yeah, at 21, were you optimistic that life was going to give you what you wanted?
Oh, yeah. I think that is something that's, in a way, just part of being youthful. I mean, Aristotle, 2,500 years ago, wrote about the optimism of youth and said it was because they haven't yet been humbled by life.
Mm.
Well, people like you and me, Kathleen, we've been humbled by life quite a lot. I mean, I think anybody, by the time they get well into adulthood, knows how humbling life can be. But I do think it's part of being young and the fact that no matter what your dreams are, nobody yet knows how the story is going to work out because it hasn't been written yet.
Yeah, you don't know. Well, Zachary, all the best to you. I wish you would let us know how you're doing a few years from now or a little while from now. Marie and Merrill, hi.
Hi. I think there's an entire flip side to this situation. I'm a retired medical nursing provider, so I'm well aware of psychological problems, changes in society, and so on. As was touched on briefly earlier in the show, the reason a lot of people aren't marrying until later is because, A, they can live together, B, contraceptive methods are much better than they used to be, even though they started coming out in the late 50s, early 60s. The expectations for women at marriage are entirely different. Men are, and people aren't going to like this, but men are willing to accept used merchandise where they probably weren't 50, 60 years ago. I think a lot of, you know, and as the commentator stated, she would love to have her son stay home with her. That's wonderful. I call that the Peter Pan syndrome, though. I thought it was very important for my son to get out of town, get out of Dodge, get an education. And like I told him when he graduated from college, we cut off his credit card that he was using for just certain things. I said, I don't care if you get a job at McDonald's. You know, I think as parents, we need a little more tough love. We make it too easy for our kids to come home. I realize there's lots of loans, but it's also easy to go to a nice private school. It's a little bit easier to get through than a cheaper state school. I think there's a lot of, and yes, there's a lot of psychological problems that can occur in the between 20 and 30. But I think in general we're babying this generation. We're giving them too many excuses to whatever. They're not willing to go to McDonald's and work. They're not willing. They probably did that in high school to support their cars rather than save for college. But, you know, there are jobs they can get. They may not like them. They may not pay $75,000 a year, and they may not have benefits. But I think there are things that they can do. And if you parents are feeling guilty that you have to explain why your child is still home, maybe there's a reason.
All right. Thanks.
Well,
Marie.
I don't know why you'd want to frame it so negatively.
Yeah, it's pretty negative.
Call it the Peter Pan syndrome. And, you know, that's just a way of stereotyping them and ridiculing them. And I don't think ridicule helps anybody develop or make their way successfully toward adulthood. I don't think it's fair to say they're not willing to work. I mean, have you been to McDonald's lately? Who's behind the counter? They're almost all people in their 20s. So I don't think you can say
they're
not willing to take those jobs. They are taking those jobs.
Okay.
They're almost entirely the workforce of the low-level service jobs because those are the jobs they're doing while they're trying to make a better life for themselves and try to make their way towards something better.
Old nurse practitioner, and I'd say, oh, are you working for the summer? Because I worked in a college town the last few years.
Uh-huh.
No. I mean, 80% of the kids don't even work during college, earning what little they can earn.
Oh, I'm not sure about that.
Well, again, your personal experience is not reflective of what's generally going on, because as I mentioned, they are more likely to be both working and going to school than
right.
your generation was when they were college age. So, you know, with all due respect to your personal experience, it doesn't reflect what life is mostly like for them. And it's just not fair to stigmatize them in this way, or to say they're the Peter Pan generation because we're indulging them too much, we're babying them. I mean, we're not as a generation, because they work harder than we did when we were their age.
Yeah. And to defend myself in the comments that you made about what I said, Marie, I meant that in terms of I dearly love my son, and I think it's very, I don't care if he's, you know, 23 and leaves the house or 40 and leaves the house. I love his company. I love being around him. I love that part of my life, and it's not, you know, I understand that people grow up. It's not that I'm holding on to him or not wanting him to leave. I understand that. But there's also something to be said about enjoying one's children. And if you can help people out, it's not coddling them. It's helping them out when they need to be helped out. There's nothing wrong with love and people loving each other in a family. I think that's a good thing. I'm not naive about this. I understand that there are problems letting people go, too. But we need to help each other. That's the motto of the hour, Jeffrey. We need to help each other as we can. All right. Caitlin in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have to somewhat agree with the last caller. I think that there's a fine line between, you know, the support that we lend the generation that we're talking about. I'm 27 years old, and my husband and I have owned a home for a couple of years. And, you know, I'm wondering, I've seen among our own group of friends, I don't necessarily see the stigma against our friends who are still living with their parents. That's just been my personal experience. However, another reflection that I have is I also see a dynamic of unrealistic spending habits among our generation. And I question if that has to tie to the culture that we're inundated with today, that is so focused on technology and lavish living and traveling and really unrealistic, unattainable things in terms of expenses for our generation who's just getting started working. And, you know, I see it, and I wonder if some of those within our generation are living beyond their means, and then it brings us to this point of financial dependence, you know, on parents or other family members.
Is that what's happening, Professor Arnett?
Well, I do think there is a fair amount of that. I think the caller is right that they have high material expectations, and especially the ones who have grown up in a middle-class family, they're used to having nice things. They're used to having a smartphone and cable TV and, you know, a decent car that's been bought within the last few years or is brand new, and you know, taking a nice vacation a couple of times a year. They're used to those things, and they expect to have them even when they might not yet have the money to afford them.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with that part of it. But I guess I would add that, you know, their parents are not that much different. It's a problem for us as a society, I think, that we have a tendency to live beyond our means, both individually and collectively. And if you think of the financial crisis that we had in 2007 and 8 that we're still recovering from, that wasn't because of emerging adults who were buying smartphones. That was because of their parents' generation buying homes they couldn't afford and going way, way too far into debt in their credit card debt. And what we've been crawling out of for the last 10 years is the effect of those spending habits, at least to some extent. And so I'm agreeing, but I would point out that it's not just people in their 20s who often spend beyond their means.
Yeah. That their spending habits in more than a few crooks on Wall Street, I would think.
Well, That too. It's definitely a complicated thing. I don't mean to oversimplify it.
Yeah. More phone calls in just a moment. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. We're talking about emerging adults this hour of the program and why we're seeing a substantial number of young people ages 18 to 29 who are living at home with their parents, what's happened financially, what the stigma is about living home at home, when is it problematic, when is it best for families and for young people. And our guest has studied this pretty extensively, Professor Jeffrey Arnett. He's mentioned in this New York Times piece that made us think about doing a show here. It was June 20th. He's been studying emerging adults for a number of years and is the author of the just-released book, Getting to 30, A Parent's Guide to the 20-something Years. He's written many other books as well, and we're listening to what you have to say, too. So we'll take more phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655. If you can't get through our email, we use those emails, talk@wpr.org, or go to our Facebook page so we can linger over your comments after the show, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls, and let us go to Colleen in Beloit. Hi, Colleen.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
Oh, yes. Go right ahead.
Okay, good. Hi. I just wanted to add another perspective as a step-parent. I'm wondering if there's any breakdown in the research or answers that your guests found regarding families, because you're kind of throwing around this word parents, you're throwing around this word families, but I know in our country and certainly in my circles, families are very non-traditional these days in the United States. So in our case, both my husband and I grew up in fairly traditional families who supported us into our young adulthood, no questions asked. But my life has changed completely, and even though I may want to be like my parents, it certainly is impossible. I'm in my late 40s, and I'm working. My husband works two jobs, and I've got older stepchildren coming home, and we may be in the small percentage of those. You know, they're not incredibly engaged in their future. And I just want to say, as a step-parent, I would imagine I represent a lot of people out there, it can be really, really stressful when you say they come home to their parents because, you know, I'm in the mix too. And I wouldn't necessarily say these are the kids that are going to support me when I'm old, but I certainly have a lot of expectations on me to support them right now. And it's difficult. It's really hard. I'd just like to hear your guest speak to that perspective on, you know, what do kids think of step-parents? You know,
okay.
What are their expectations of parents, including step-parents?
All right. Thanks, Colleen.
That's a great question. I'm so glad you called because this is a substantial proportion of the population. As everybody knows, the divorce rate is about 50%, and most people who divorce remarry, although certainly not all of them. You have a lot of single moms who didn't remarry because moms are less likely than dads to remarry after a divorce. And so a lot of the single moms, they're especially happy to have their kids come home because that gives them the companionship, you know, somebody to share dinner with and go to the movies with. But there are a lot of step-parents as well, and it often does end up in just the kind of situation your caller reflected, which is that the step-parents do not want the kids home. That step-parent-child relationship, it tends to be problematic. Not always, but it's more likely to be conflictual than a parent-child relationship is. And so when the kids leave home for college or for independent living, in their late teens, early 20s, the step-parents tend to be glad to see them go. And then not all that happy to have them move back again when the kids come back. And the old conflicts tend to reemerge about the step-kids maybe resenting the step-parent for being around at all and the step-parents resenting their partner's kids for draining away the family resources and so on. So it does tend to be problematic. It's more likely to be problematic than when the child is coming home to the household of two biological parents. And I think it's important to mention here, too, that one aspect of this that's really crucial is that children in step families are much less likely to get a college degree, and it tends to be because their parent and step parent are less likely to be willing to support them in their college education. So that's a problem for the emerging adults, and another source of resentment between emerging adults and their step parents.
Thanks, Colleen, so much for your call. I don't know if we've made it easier, but it was good to hear from you. Bob in La Crosse, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. Both my wife and myself stayed with our parents late in life, mid-20s plus, and now we have children in their mid-20s, and they're staying with us, but we're happy most of the time. one child really successful, and the other one struggles with issues that need full attention at all times, not physical issues either. So we kind of gang together to help each other. Sometimes it's physical, and sometimes it's, you know, emotional or whatever, just all kind of band together. But I was wondering if the writer had ever heard of the term trustafarian. That's kind of a common term around our house with kids. Their friends that live at home, they're known as the trustafarians because they don't have to work and they know it.
No, I haven't heard that term. It refers to somebody who has wealthy parents that are so wealthy that they don't need to work.
They're now officially trustafarians, and they know that they'll never work again, and they just kind of hang out.
I learned something today.
I did too.
I'm interested to learn it. It's certainly a rare condition to be in,
right?
To have parents that are so wealthy that you don't need to work. And I do think there's a substantial body of work that suggests when kids are given too much, too easily, and too early, it saps their own motivation. So I think that's probably what's going on there. But it's a rare condition, as I said. Most of them are, most emerging adults are making their way toward adulthood through dint of their own hard work, and their parents, if their parents are able to support them, it's a great advantage in terms of them getting a college degree that is so important as the basis for adult economic life today. But most emerging adults, they're lucky if they can get that much parental support. They don't have to worry about being trustafarians.
Right. Thanks, Bob. Jeff in Berlin, hi. We're almost out of time. Jeff, hi.
Yep, just real quick. I think this is really an exciting time because academia has convinced the majority of people that they have to have a college education, so they automatically come out of school possibly $60,000-$75,000 in debt before they're even able to get established. That's allowing your regular, normal person to have 4 or 5 years advantage over those people and actually be able to perform service for those folks that aren't willing to do stuff for themselves anymore.
Well, first of all, it's not academics that have convinced people of that. It's the reality of the modern economy, which has shifted over the last 50 years from a mainly manufacturing economy to a service economy that requires information and technology skills, and so requires some kind of education or training after high school. Secondly, it's about half of college graduates who have any debt at all following their college graduation. And so the average debt among that half who has any debt currently is about $29,000. That's a lot of money. And as I said earlier in the conversation, I think tertiary education should be free. I think it should be an investment that a society makes in its future and in its young people. But even for those who have debt, it's $29,000 on average, and that's against a lifetime's earning advantage of $1 million. Mm. So it's a pretty good investment.
Yeah, Jeffrey, we're out of time. Thank you so much.
It was really an interesting hour.
Thanks. Jeffrey Arnett, our guest this hour of the program, talking about emerging adulthood. Boomerang Kids is another expression that's been used. He is the originator of the theory. He is research professor in the Department of Psychology at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this program, and thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Great conversations ahead. Thank you for listening to us today, and we'll be with you again soon on the Ideas Network.